This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. When it comes to the local economy, these are pretty good times for Boston. It remains, of course, a global center for higher education, where leading research universities spin off companies that contribute to a robust local economy, which weathered the Great Recession much better than most cities.
Boston also has a thriving financial sector and a vibrant high-tech industry. You can see evidence of wealth from the expanding Seaport District to Downtown Crossing's 15-story Millennium Place development with its seven-figure condos.
But there's another side of Boston, a large part of the population that is being left behind. In fact, census data shows Boston has the least equitable income distribution, the widest income gap of any large city in America.
Which is why Boston's new mayor, Marty Walsh, has been talking a lot about economic inequality. Here he is last month at his inauguration.
We will expand opportunity so it reaches every person in every corner of our city. We cannot tolerate a city divided by privilege and poverty. We will protect and grow our sense of community.
Walsh is one of many big city mayors, from Tom Menino before him to Bill de Blasio of New York to Ed Murray of Seattle, trying to combat the growing gap between the very rich and the very poor.
But what can a mayor actually do? What policies really work? And to what extent is the inequality the result of national and global forces beyond a mayor's reach? We're going to spend a little time now talking about these questions. We'd love to have you join the conversation. Let us know what you think about these questions or what questions you have. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're talking about inequality, how to close that gap in Boston. We're also at Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston. And joining us here in the studio is Ed Glaser, professor of economics at Harvard and author of Triumph of the City. And welcome back to Radio Boston, Ed Glaser. Great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us is Tiziana Deering. She's professor of practice at Boston College Graduate School of Social Work. Welcome to you, Professor Deering. Great to have you. And thank you both for braving this weather, by the way, and making it in here. We're really very grateful.
It's a worthy subject.
Okay, I think it is too. And Ed Glaser, let me start with you. Is the kind of economic inequality that exists in Boston a sort of natural outcome of the economic success that is so evident in Boston?
Well, it's natural, but that doesn't mean we should accept the status quo. Mm. So cities have been unequal for at least 2,500 years, when Plato wrote about how any city of whatever size gets split into two cities, one rich and one poor. And in some sense, there's an aspect of urban inequality that paradoxically cities should even be proud of. Mm. Boston has poverty, and it has significant poverty. More than a quarter of Boston's children are growing up in poverty, and that is terrible. But one of the reasons that it has that poverty is that it is a place in which you can get around without a car for every adult. It is a place that still has some affordable housing. It is a place that has decent social services. And the type of equality that we see in some of our suburbs that have zoned out low-cost housing, that have made it impossible without anyone who has an abundance of cars to move around, that kind of equality is not something to be cherished. So give me the inequality of the city that manages to both attract the rich and attract the poor alike, which in some sense is just another way of saying diversity, yeah, to the false equality of the suburbs.
Nice. Interesting. So is that to say, though, that dealing with the inequality and trying to smooth out the bumps at the lower end of the economic ladder would somehow hurt cities?
Of course not.
No.
And of course, I stand 100% behind Mayor Walsh and his desire to try and make sure that there's more opportunity in the city. And it's both about opportunity, and I'm sure Tiziana will talk about how to take steps to make the lives of the poor better, which are things that we should be deeply passionate about. Mm. We should recognize that if we make the lives of the poor better, then we will have more poor people in Boston because more poor people will come. But that's good. That's actually what the city should be doing.
Yeah. Well, Tiziana, let me turn to you. You're a social justice veteran, a strong advocate for economic mobility. How do you define the challenge here?
Well, I think you just layer on to what Ed is talking about, right? So you attract a diverse population into a city, and a city like Boston has wonderful promise to create economic opportunity for people. But then you have to ask, okay, well, who's getting the economic opportunity? Mm-hmm. How easy is it to rise? And is your ability to rise overly or at all correlated with things like where you were born, what race you are, what school you're in, what's happening in your neighborhood? And those are the pressure points that we need to push on. Mm. It's not just inequality. It's inequality married with mobility. Mm-hmm. And can you go where you want to go if you're trying?
Yeah. And what's the sort of number one conveyor of mobility, or an example of what you're talking about when you're talking about getting to that mobility?
I have to confess, you know, the pat answer is that education is the number one conveyor of mobility. Yeah. And while education is very important, I believe part of our problem is that we're seeking a one conveyor of mobility. And there isn't one conveyor of mobility. There's a, believe it or not, there's a social capital component. There's an access to investment capital component. There's the ability to save. There's an education for more competitive knowledge-based jobs. Mm. There's asset building like home ownership and other kinds of savings. The part of the problem is we keep looking for the one silver bullet, and there isn't one. And that's not a bad thing. That just means we got to be more complex.
Well, one of the sort of focuses of this conversation where I sort of began it is, you know, what can a mayor do? One mayor, one city administration. And I want to ask this question about that, because there are those who would argue that the ultimate causes of inequality aren't local. They're global. It's the result of declining manufacturing, the rise of globalization. So, Ed Glaser, I'll come back to you. Aren't these forces ultimately beyond a mayor? Control?
Many of them are very hard for a mayor to fight, and many of them are the result of broader tectonic changes in the world economy. But that doesn't mean that the solution can't come in part from mayors. Look, I don't think we have a great track record of coming up with solutions at the top for these problems right now in this country. This isn't where the national government is. And I think if we're going to figure out solutions that actually engender opportunity, that engender mobility, they are much more likely to come from the local level. Now, there are profound limits on what a mayor can do. And the mayor of Boston is limited by mobility, by the fact that if he tries to target the very rich and engage in punitive taxes, Brookline just isn't very far away, mm-hmm. right? And even more so than in New York.
And people will vote with their feet.
People will vote with their feet. And on top of that, right, this is a state in which the mayor is very constrained constitutionally, right? There is not only is it, you know, impossible for the city of Boston to pass a tax on people earning more than $1 million on itself. Right now, by state constitution, the state can't even do that. So we have profound legal and, you know, and as well as the mobility reasons that limit the mayor. But that doesn't mean that, in fact, we can't try things and we can't achieve things. And in some sense, given that we know that the nation as a whole doesn't yet feel like it's in a place to engage in large-scale redistribution, perhaps those incremental innovative changes that Boston can do can in fact be the harbinger of something much greater at the national level.
You know, I'm glad you brought up that fact about the state constitution denies the mayor the power to levy new taxes. I know Bill de Blasio in New York, for example, wants to raise taxes on the rich to pay for extended preschool and after-school programs. But Mayor Walsh is also talking, Tiziana Deering, about universal preschool. It's expensive, but it's important. Is that one of those important components of mobility that we're talking about? Universal preschool, and that's certainly something a mayor can push for.
Well, all of the science indicates that the earlier you can help children in brain development with emotional stability, reduce trauma, give them better access to reading and vocabulary, it launches them on a better path. Mm. Universal preschool is a way to go at that, and probably as good a way as any that we know to go at that. As long as that's done in conjunction with working with families and neighborhoods to create a learning environment broadly in a neighborhood.
Yeah.
Certainly we know that early intervention with children is important.
Can we afford it? I was looking at numbers, $32 million just for the first year of a universal preschool program.
You know, Anthony, that's such an interesting question. We have consistently had a detention over prevention way of thinking about investment. Mm. That's not unique to us, but it's certainly true about us. And we always look at how much it's going to cost to invest in it. We never look at the cost of the back end, right?
Yeah, okay.
There's data out there to show that the cost to a community of somebody who doesn't graduate high school is a minimum of $250,000 per person. So $32 million for all of the little kids in Boston starts to look like a smart prevention investment versus a detention investment on the back end.
Interesting.
I think we can't afford not to, quite honestly. I think our human capital is too important not to waste. I would stress that it's clear that there are heterogeneous results from different pre-K interventions. So the early interventions, Perry Preschool, the Absiderian Project, these were enormously successful interventions that had unbelievably great long-term results. Head Start, the results are much more mixed. A large national program, much more mixed. Mm-hmm. And I think as a result, it's critical to get it right. And I think part of that probably involves more innovation, experimentation against a sort of one-size-fits-all model that's mixed with constant evaluation of these grades. So get more entrepreneurship in the sector, get more innovation in the sector.
Which is a good recipe for us, I think, in general.
Yeah. All right. Listeners, I just want to reset this conversation. We are talking about the economic divide in Boston. It's the city, the large American city with the biggest economic divide. And we're asking, what can a mayor actually do? What policies work? To what extent are forces beyond his control or within his control? Let us know what you think. 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've got two great and smart guests here talking about this, Ed Glaser and Tiziana Deering. Earlier today, we spoke to Dan Coe, Mayor Marty Walsh's chief of staff. We asked him about bridging the economic divide, and he talked about stepping up development in parts of the city that have been historically left behind. So here's what he said.
How do we revitalize different areas of Boston in ways that make it exciting from an outsider's perspective and also internally? So an example is the Ferdinand Building in the Dudley area. It's undergoing an incredible renovation. Boston Public Schools is going to be there. We'll have a great anchor tenant. And we really think that that is going to be the start of a revitalization of that neighborhood.
I'd like to ask you both about that. Ed Glaser, I know you argued recently in a Boston Globe op-ed in favor of spreading new business opportunities more widely. And you talked about Dudley Square in Roxbury.
I did. And I think there's a lot to recommend Dudley Square. I don't feel that strongly about Dudley versus other areas that get into the heart of the city. But I think clearly we need to think about innovation districts that go beyond the waterfront. And to me, to be sustainable, this model needs to be not about large-scale tax incentives for businesses to locate there, but with a very skill-intensive orientation. And when I think about what one vision for Dudley Square would be, it involves some sort of physical headquarters, an incubator space for startups. It involves a close tie with Roxbury Community College, with schools in the neighborhood, that ensures that there's at least one person whose job it is to get entrepreneurs into the schools and to get the kids into the businesses in order to connect the two. It involves an attitude on the part of Boston Public Schools that makes them very open to electronic learning innovations, so that entrepreneurs who want to figure out new ways of teaching kids whatever skills they want to teach them come to Boston as a natural place to actually try these things out. This is something that BPS should be doing, whether or not we have in mind a Dudley Square Innovation District, but it's something that would actually anchor this particular area. And I've also argued that this would be a great place to start out a new permitting regime, a new and faster permitting regime for new businesses. Now, for many tech businesses, the permitting regime isn't that difficult because it's not as if they have to get huge numbers of things. But any of the support business, from a cafe to a grocery store, often has to run a gauntlet of permitting. Mm-hmm. Now, we can't rewrite all the permitting in Boston overnight, but at the very least, you could have a one-stop permitting officer whose job it was to speed everything through for everyone and get them through the permitting process.
And the idea here, smaller business and businesses in parts of the city that have been left behind economically would have a little bit easier time sort of
exactly. I mean, I would change the whole permitting environment for them and make it easier. But at the very least, have a person who's dedicated to permitting in disadvantaged areas that makes sure it's as easy as possible it is to start your grocery store in a poor neighborhood.
We're talking about some real specifics here. And Tiziana, I'm wondering, are you hearing from this new administration this level of specific, of detail about in terms of, you know, what needs to happen?
I'm hearing openness to this type of specificity and detail. And I think that actually started during the campaign, well before Mayor Walsh won the election. I think everybody's got a sense both that we've got to be doing some things differently, that we are in a lot of places where we want to be and in some places not at all where we want to be, and that there's a sort of a natural innovation spirit to Boston that should be a part of the solution. I've sort of long said to myself that Boston is America's civic incubator. You know, civic improvements come out of Boston. It's part of our DNA and part of our history. And I think that openness is there. The other thing that I would love to be able to add to what Ed said,
please.
I ran an anti-poverty fund in the Grove Hall neighborhood, and one of the projects that we did was ask lots of incredibly diverse people what it took for them to rise. And one of the things that we heard very consistently was, key to my rising was that someone else believed in me. Hmm. And not only is that true for an individual, but that's true for a neighborhood and a community. And if we begin to say we can do innovation someplace other than the Seaport District, right? We can build, we can bring businesses in, we can make investments in new forms of technology, we can think of small-scale manufacturing on three streets in Roxbury. We begin to believe in a neighborhood and respect the way a neighborhood believes in itself. And that changes behavior. And those are things a mayor can do.
Interesting. Listeners, let's go to a couple of our listeners who are standing by to get involved in this conversation. Anne is calling from Dorchester. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm a teacher on the Dorchester-Roxbury line, and I'm a Boston Public School teacher, obviously. And I think it's really important for the mayor to get out and meet parents in the Dudley, Grove Hall, Strand neighborhood, and I think it's critical to go out and speak with teachers. Teachers are on the front line of working with children up below the poverty line. They hear the stories. They hear parents' struggles. They are an incredible resource that is underused in finding the connection with the families that are in these neighborhoods. I don't think the point of turning Dudley or Grove Hall into an innovation district is to outprice these families and make it so that families that have been there for two, three, four generations, all of a sudden, you know, you've got a little South End and they have to pull up stakes, because that, I don't think, is what Mayor Walsh wants to do. But the resource of families and teachers first. And come out of your academic buildings, come out of City Hall, come meet us, come ask us what we're seeing, come ask our suggestions. We're eager to let you know what we see every day working with this population.
And you put a couple of interesting ideas on the table, and I'm going to take them up with our guests. But one thing I want to come back to you and ask you about, do you get a sense that this administration is coming out and actually listening to what you have to say? Are you hearing that?
Well, I don't want to be critical of an administration that's only been at it about a month or so, but I'm just making that suggestion because I think, you know, you have a lot of people who work in academia who are consulting him, and you have other people in areas of government, and I just hope he takes the opportunity to come out, visit schools, meet with parents, meet with teachers.
Okay.
Because we're the people living it every day.
And we hear you loud and clear, and thanks for the call. I'd like to ask Ed Glazer and Tiziana Deering both about the point that Ann made. I'll start with you, Ed Glazer, the concern that turning it into an innovation district, don't turn that part of the city into another South End and price people out of it.
I think that's right. And I think we all worry about it having too much place-based aid that doesn't help people. Right. So the point is not to create a shiny place. The point is to help the people there. Now, there are two things that we have to potentially work on that. One of which, and I was arguing very strongly for a policy that included the schools and part of the district and worked hard to get the kids enmeshed. And I think that's absolutely central. The other point that's critical is that you've got to combine anything that revitalizes a neighborhood with new housing supply, that doesn't displace the people who are there, mm-hmm. but that actually provides enough new homes so that you're not crowding out, you're not pushing out the people who are already living there. And that's really absolutely central, is you need to make sure that when a city gets better, you need to make sure that there are more homes for more people to afford Boston, and that this does not become a boutique town affordable only by the wealthy.
Yeah, and this is a big, big issue, isn't it, Tiziana? I mean, the price of housing in Boston, very, very, very high.
Well, housing is an issue, both in the fact that the price is high, but also because historically part of the way that people have worked their way to a higher socioeconomic position is through the assets they build, through things like homeownership. Mm-hmm. Homeownership for a long time was a huge part of the strategy of how you entered and sustained for your children in the middle class. And if that's cut out, it gets harder to build assets and equity. We have in Greater Boston, by one economic report, the asset difference between the top quintile and the bottom quintile is almost 200 times, right? So when you have that and you don't have ways to build assets, that becomes a struggle.
So getting back to this sort of central idea of what can a mayor do, what's the sort of single best policy that a mayor can embrace to improve, increase the housing stock for people who need housing?
Go ahead.
Well, I think this all comes down to the permitting process fundamentally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not – there are, of course, things that the mayor can do to subsidize housing as well, but that's expensive and there are limits to that. I think the main thing is about housing, there's no repealing the laws of supply and demand. If you don't build and a place becomes attractive, it becomes expensive. So the key is to make sure that the BRA, as it becomes more open, as it becomes more accountable, also makes sure that enough permits are flowing, that those permits are particularly targeted towards – areas in which the buildings will house people of more modest means, but it's fundamentally about supply.
Tiziana, you wanted to add to that?
Well, I actually was going to go in a little bit different direction.
Please
which
do.
Is our caller, her assumption, and I understand this assumption about innovation districts, is that what we want to do or we're advocating for is turning other neighborhoods into high-tech zones. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of ways to think about innovation, right? And you can turn your concepts of innovation towards solving all kinds of public problems, social problems, community problems. We probably also need to rethink the role of technology away from let's use technology to drive productivity by reducing human labor and saying how can we marry new forms of technology with new opportunities for human labor and invest in innovation in those ways in our Boston neighborhoods. Again, something that a mayor can try to incentivize and carry the message forward on.
So a lot to do that a mayor can do. Ed Glaser, I want to come back to a proposal that you've made, speaking about increasing the housing supply. You're someone who has joined a lot of people talking about this idea of taxing land, not buildings, as a way to help cities thrive and make housing more affordable. How does that work?
Well, if you go back to the late 19th century in another age of gilded inequality, right, Henry George advocated a single tax on land as the best way of redistributing income and creating a fairer, more efficient system. Now, I don't think a single tax on land is likely to be the right answer to all inequality, but it is, in fact, a good answer to try and reduce the incentives not to build. So right now, you pay higher taxes if you build up. The more units that you're building, the more the value of the structure goes up, the greater your property tax bill goes
up.
We don't want that, right? We want to encourage guys to build. And quite frankly, we should charge someone the same whether or not he leaves his lot open and puts cars on it as a garage or whether or not he builds a 30-floor tower. So that's basically the idea of this, is to try and level the property tax playing field so the people who have kept their land underutilized pay more and the people who have delivered more housing units that Boston badly needs pay less.
Yeah, and now is that something that a mayor has influence over?
Well, the mayor will have to go to Beacon Hill and talk to talk to the state legislature about that, because as in so many cases, right, any sort of radical public innovation of this nature is going to require the state legislature to sign off on it.
What about in terms of helping cities, in terms of helping cities close this economic gap, help from Washington? Given the paralysis inside the Beltway, is there any hope that federal policies can help alleviate this growing economic divide? Tiziana.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting to see over time is the extent to which the Dudley Street Corridor's adoption of Promise Neighborhoods, which was a federal program, has been part of what is driving the sort of thriving promise and growth there. I have mixed feelings because that seemed to me a community that was going to do that on its own either way. But perhaps Promise Neighborhoods, which was a federal undertaking, has accelerated that, supported that, or even just given a basis for people to come together and collaborate faster and more easily.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, an interesting one to look at quite specifically for Boston.
Interesting idea.
You know, I liked Race to the Top a lot. I thought that was a very creative use of the central government trying to nudge communities and to engage in more innovation in education, and I'd like to see more of that. But I think in order to bridge the partisan divide that so stymies Washington right now, we're going to need to figure out local solutions that don't feel like they're traditional left-wing or right-wing policies, policies that are about opportunity. And indeed, you know, reducing permitting barriers in low-income areas is something which presumably the GOP would be at least as enthusiastic about as the Democrats would be. Or figuring out smart ways to do entrepreneurial pre-K is something that, you know, it's hard to stand against small children, no matter what your political stripes are. So I think there are ways in which we can potentially get Washington excited about this, but we need to have a new script.
Interesting.
We can't use the old one.
And you know, getting back to this idea of what a mayor can do, I mean, it seems to me we're living at a time, and we've done segments on this program, the idea that cities represent one of the more promising sources of new public policy these days, especially given the paralysis we're seeing in Washington. Do both of you agree with that, Tiziana?
Absolutely. Yeah. I completely agree. And I think if we think of ourselves as having a hierarchy where, of course, I come out of the nonprofit sector, right, where I believe nonprofits are a promising place to test innovation and try new ideas, cities then can adopt those on a slightly larger scale. That can then convert to state-level and federal-level policy. But it is always the case that something smaller, but it's mostly the case that something smaller can happen faster with faster results and easier collaboration.
Ed Glaser, final thought from you on cities as sort of incubators of the most promising new sources of policy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, cities have come back because of entrepreneurship that have caused regional economies, local economies to become dynamic. What we need is more governmental versions of that, and that means more innovation, more evaluation of that innovation.
All right. Ed Glaser, professor of economics at Harvard University, author of Triumph of the City. Thanks for joining us so much and kicking this conversation off. Also with us, Tiziana Deering, professor of practice at Boston College Graduate School of Social Work. Tiziana, great to have you in as well.
Great to be here.
And many thanks as well to WBUR's David Scharfenberg, who helped us in a big way with this segment. And be sure to listen to his report tomorrow morning on this very subject. That's on WBUR's Morning Edition. Stay with us. Coming up, the rocking Brookline-born soul man Eli Paperboy Reed is with us. Hold on to your hats. I'm Anthony Brooks with Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.